The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Mark Gopin, director of the Center on Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and happy 4th of July. While you might not think of this as a particularly Jewish holiday, we Jews have been an important part of the American experience from colonial times, and there have been important figures at every point of American history. And one of the most important American Jewish figures is, paradoxically, also one of the least known. You'll find out who that is in just a few moments. In July of 1776, when the Continental Congress took the revolutionary step of declaring independence, by the way, it actually happened on July 2nd, but we celebrate the 4th because that's when the additional clauses of the Declaration of Independence were voted on. Anyway, Congress had essentially very, very limited means of raising funds that it needed to fight a major war against the most powerful navy and army in the world. So, how was Congress going to finance it? Well, same way governments have been financing war since time immemorial. Congress borrowed the money. And ultimately, the most successful and most honest financier who helped the nascent American Congress borrow the money that allowed us to defeat Great Britain was a guy named Chaim Soloman. When my family and I were in Virginia a couple of weeks ago, we drove past Yorktown, the National Battlefield Monument. It was at Yorktown, of course, that the British Army was trapped by George Washington and our French allies, and that the Revolutionary War, which had meandered on for more than six long, hard years, finally came to an end when Cornwallis surrendered. Anyway, the key man in that whole Yorktown campaign was not Washington or Lafayette or the Count of Rochambeau. It was Chaim Soloman. I'll explain that in a minute. Who was Chaim Soloman? He was a Polish Jew born in 1740, son of a rabbi, went into trade and finance in a small way, traveled throughout Europe, learned several languages, and returned to Poland. But when Poland was dismembered by greater European powers in 1772, not for the first time and certainly not for the last time, Chaim Soloman left Poland for England. A couple of years later, took ship for New York, arriving here in 1775. He became a financial broker specializing in overseas commerce. And shortly after he got here, he joined the Sons of Liberty to work for American independence. In 1776, yes, that revolutionary year, Chaim Soloman was arrested by the British as a spy and kept on a prison hulk, an old rotting ship, out in New York Harbor, where he supposedly was tortured by the British. After 18 months, Soloman was released because the British needed him to be a translator for their German Hessian mercenary allies. Ironically, Mayor Amschel Rothschild, founder of the great Rothschild banking house, was at the exact same time loyally serving the prince of the German state of Hesse-Cassel as an important financial advisor, the very same state that was supplying the Hessian mercenaries who fought against the American army. In any case, Chaim Soloman used his position as an interpreter to help American prisoners of the British escape and to encourage Hessian soldiers to desert the British cause. The British, unsurprisingly, did not look kindly on this. He was rearrested in 1778, but this time he himself escaped and managed to get to Philadelphia, the rebel capital. Once resettled, Chaim Soloman resumed his activities as a broker. He became an agent of the French consul, as well as the paymaster for the French forces in North America. And in 1781, he began working extensively with Robert Morris, the newly appointed superintendent for finance for the 13 American colonies. Eventually, Solomon sold about $600,000 in bills of exchange to his clients. That was the way that the money was borrowed to finance the American army. Finally, in August of 1781, the Continental Army trapped Lieutenant General Charles Cornwallis in the little Virginia coastal town of Yorktown. Washington and the main army and the Count of Rochambeau with his French army decided to march from the Hudson Highlands all the way down to Yorktown to deliver the coup de grace, the final blow. But Washington's war chest was completely empty, and so was that of Congress. Washington decided he needed about $20,000 to finance the campaign. When Morris told him there were no funds and no credit, Washington gave a simple but eloquent order: send for Chaim Solomon. And Chaim Solomon again came through. The $20,000 was raised, George Washington ran the Yorktown campaign, it was the final battle of the Revolution, and we won. And that's why we celebrate the 4th of July nowadays, all thanks to Chaim Solomon. Solomon also personally supported a variety of members of the Continental Congress during their stay in Philadelphia, including James Madison and James Wilson, and supposedly Thomas Jefferson. Acting as the patriot he was, he requested below-market interest rates and never asked for repayment, which, most of those guys being Virginia planters, he never got. The Treaty of Paris, signed on September 3, 1783, ended the Revolutionary War and established the United States, but it did not end the financial problems of the newly established America. Chaim Solomon again managed, time and again, to raise the money to bail out the debt-ridden American government. Does that sound familiar? In 1975, the U.S. Postal Service issued a commemorative stamp honoring Chaim Solomon for his many contributions to the cause of the American Revolution. That stamp was printed on front and back. On the glue side of the stamp, these words were printed in pale green ink. Appropriately green, I think, and not red. Financial hero, businessman, and broker Chaim Solomon was responsible for raising most of the money needed to finance the American Revolution and later saving the new nation from economic collapse. There are many other legends about Chaim Solomon, some of which are probably true, such as the one that says without his personal advances during the Valley Forge winters, the American army and the cause of liberty and revolution would have failed completely. Chaim Solomon was a true patriot, and like many true believers, he paid a high price for his devotion to the cause. When he died, he was owed substantial sums by the American Congress. You know, never legendary for its repayment, and much worse in the early days of the Articles of Confederation. Anyway, Solomon may have been a wealthy man during his lifetime, but he left substantial debts behind. But he also left something much greater: an independent, growing, solvent United States of America, and a Jewish legacy of crucial work for the health and welfare of our country. This is a good day to reflect on the whole idea of Jewish identity in America. For many generations, we struggle with just how complete our acceptance has been in American society. Yet, today, Jews have run for president, vice president, been cabinet officers, Supreme Court justices, a big part of the Senate and House, had all kinds of movies made about us. We've been accepted to country clubs and social organizations, owned and played on World Series and Super Bowl and even NBA and NHL championship-winning teams, and been widely accepted within American society to a degree that seems to imply, at least most of the time, full acceptance by almost all of America. The issues we face now are much more focused on whether we will choose to be Jewish in meaningful, resilient, enduring ways now that we are fully American. In a way, acceptance itself can be a bit disillusioning. You know what happens when you get what you ask for and the results aren't what you expect? Ah. Well, we Jews are now about as American as baseball and apple pie. Unfortunately, that sometimes means we're about as Jewish as baseball and apple pie, too.
And I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease.
This reminds me of a Paul Simon song from my teens, the lovely and slightly sad American tune about all American immigrants' embrace of liberty and the disappointments and pragmatism of just making it through every day. To highlight the bluesy quality of Simon's original song, Mandy Patinkin recorded it in Yiddish on his Mama Lushan album, a perfect play-in for this Too Jewish show for the 4th of July, to be American, Jewish, hopeful, and a little sad.
Gut azoy Ich bin heiß kein Mutschitten hoch. Wäsch riecht sich aber es so lustig, freudig sein, als euren Goh ist Goh. Als euren Goh ist Goh. Seinen meine Bekannte alle zunehmend. Ich hab kein Fein, was geht im Wollen. Weiß mir auch allem, was ist nicht und siehst. Von Teublech geworden Feuer. Nord gesetzt. Gut, als euch lang heigle. Nur ich will von unser Begonnen kleinen Feind, wo seinen mir verfolgen. Sei Meucher, wo seinen mir verfolgen. Der Malcher Morgen nimmt meine Schumme putzen Meucher rein. Sie guckt darauf im Gebäude, schmeckt bei ruhig bei. Und ich flieh wie ein Maler. Statue of Liberty, was the gold weit von ihm, und ich flieh wie ein Maler. Zu helles Heilen führt uns der größer Schiff, heute aller Wonne schief mir ringen, der Schaff und Geurel ist mit uns scheiner. A Lied von Amerika mir singen, nur gut ist es, gut als euch, euch erbrochen auf Adel. Der heimte Kirche bis wird morgen euch erwähnt, sich obruhen ist mein Zweck. Azoi zichopuen is mein stay.
The paradoxical nature of American Jewish identity is particularly appropriate considering that when Paul Simon wrote the American tune song, the president of the U.S. was Richard Nixon, who felt free to be brutally anti-Semitic in his private commentary, while publicly having the very Jewish Henry Kissinger run our foreign policy. And you know, it was Nixon and Kissinger who saved Israel during the Yom Kippur War by arranging an emergency airlift of supplies. Well, thank God we live in different times. Overt anti-Semitism in America is pretty much unacceptable, and Israel is a much stronger and more secure nation. And nowadays, we have an African-American president whose chief of staff is the very Jewish Rahm Emanuel, and he tells Israel to shape up or else. Well, it's kind of improvement, isn't it? Perhaps we need a new American Jewish tune to celebrate our identity on this 4th of July.
If everybody had a Torah across the USA, then everybody'd be Jewish like you and me. Today you'd see him wearing a tali in shul on Saturday. If everybody was Jewish, Jewish USA, you'd see a Jew in the White House and in the NBA racing into 500, running the NRA. There's no KKK.
Jewish, Jewish USA.
Jewish USA.
Okay, maybe Doug Kotler's song isn't actually the ideal new anthem from American Judaism on the 4th of July of 2010, but what the heck, it's fun. When we come back on Too Jewish This Morning, our guest will be Rabbi Mark Gopin, director of the Center for Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University, and a key figure in envisioning new ways to solve the world's problems without warfare and with religion at its heart. Find out how that can work when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-oneg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation, just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Mark Gopin, who's also a rabbi, is the James Lau Professor of Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution, and the director of the Center on Religion, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University's Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. That is a lot of words in a title. Dr. Gopin has lectured on conflict resolution all around the world, Switzerland, Ireland, India, Italy, and Israel, as well as at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Princeton, and a few other rather credible academic institutions. He has trained thousands of people worldwide in peacemaking strategies for complex conflicts in which religion and culture play a role, conducts research on values, dilemmas, as they apply to international problems of globalization. And he has a very interesting blog that is well worth reading and exploring. He's also been on TV and on the radio and in all kinds of publications over a long period of time. We welcome Mark Gopin. Good morning.
Good morning. Wonderful to talk to you.
It's a pleasure. You know, so many people see religion as a problem in the world and as the source of conflict. You see it as much more than that. Can you explain a little bit about your perspective on it?
Well, I think that as you go deeper into most conflicts, you discover that actually religion is not as implicated as everybody thought. There are issues of the structures of society, of classes, of people, of politicians who are using religion to further their military or political aims. And then when you get into the solutions, you discover an awful lot of religious people who are actually at the forefront of the solutions in addition to those who are radicalizing populations. So the actual role of religion is complex in both sides.
In the Middle East, which is the region of conflict closest to the heart of so many Jews and many listeners of Too Jewish, you have said that your book really focused on that. The whole Oslo process was flawed because it exempted religion from the process, tried to make it a secular political process. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it is, because first of all, it did not recognize that religion is very, very close to the heart of people and to a lot of their basic needs. Religion cares a great deal. All the major religions are quite concerned about issues of safety, security, family integrity, and also social justice. And so that if you don't, if your process is so elite that it's only dealing with a few people, you can be sure that those who feel left out will immediately move to religion as the place where they have their voice. So you sort of set up an out-group from the very beginning. And when you look at the complicated dynamics of both Israeli and Palestinian society, you see that there's been a struggle on religion and secular identity from the very beginning. So by leaving it out of peace, you basically were putting it in the realm of war. And conversely, by not using the opportunities that religion provides you, when you have imams, rabbis, others arguing from a position of religion for peace, they were wasting an opportunity to change the hearts and minds of the people in the region towards peace. So for all of those reasons, Oslo, I felt, was not getting to the depths of the problem, did not cast a wide enough net, and therefore set itself up for disappointment.
Many people are saying that now, but you said it a while back. In the course of the process, we'll continue to explore issues of peace and conflict resolution with Dr. Mark Gopin when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as podcasts. In honor of the 4th of July, here's a special comedy clip from comedian Robert Klein about the American flag and growing up Jewish in his day.
I carried the New York City flag in the assembly at PS94. That's the blue flag there, you may remember, with the emblem on it of the white man jipping the Indian. When you're holding that heavy flag, you know, at the risk of dropping it, everything seems extra long. Some illiterate kid used to read the psalm. You're not allowed to do that anymore. I think they cut it out because it was boring. I don't think there were any religious things involved. You know. They just chose illiterates to read the psalm, being prompted by a teacher. Lord is my shepherd. Shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me light. And everyone's going, including God. Let's go with him. A little earthquake to cause in Argentina in 20 minutes. I remember once the kid who carried the American flag dropped it. By accident. He tripped. I assume it was an accident. Who knows? Maybe a communist stuck his foot out. You know. Tripped him. Yeah, they do that. You know, they send their kids and they go into the thing, trip them, yay, mao. They give the signal. And they give the special communist handshake. But the kid dropped the American flag. And it blew his mind. Because they imbued the flag with a special power beyond itself. Like, you know, who knows? He started to bend down and kiss the little gold fringes on the side, those little titsis things, you know, inside. Under the approving eye of an adult teacher. That's it, kiss the broadcloth. Very nice. You know. Give it a nice kiss, that'll make everything all better, you know. Children fantasize, something like George Washington's gonna pop out. Hey, you'll drop me! After all I suffered at Valley Forge, you little Jew boy!
Comedian Robert Klein, in honor of the 4th of July. We welcome our Mevinar expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, it's 4th of July weekend and America's birthday. we think about this country as one founded in liberty. And I think about, well, times have been worse. Times have also been better. And my Tom Paine's famous statement about the summer soldier and the sunshine patriot in the revolutionary times. But maybe liberty matters even more when things are tough and you might sacrifice that for other values.
It's very, I think that's such an important conversation that we need to be having now. First of all, you know, you think about the word liberty, but I think there's a lot of different angles to that. Freedom, is freedom the same as liberty? Well, certainly not in the Jewish vernacular. I mean, we've talked on another show where there are multiple words, actually, for the word freedom. There's freedom, like a vacation, you know, a chofesh. And there's, you know, like what you want to take right now and
right.
be in San Diego.
Yeah.
There's the notion of a freedom dror, which is sort of the spiritual freedom, the mind
right.
being free to think. And then there's
chirut.
Exactly, which is a freedom that's really linked to responsibility. Liberty, we've talked about this as well. You know, liberty, I think, in the Anglo sense, means we are entitled to certain things in this country. We have a Bill of Rights, we have a Constitution, and we believe in those. And we have protections and guarantees, and we are founded on those protections and guarantees. And the Founding Fathers felt it was very important to establish those and codify those early on, the freedom of the press, the freedom of religion, the freedom of being free from unreasonable searches and seizures. You know, we've developed those freedoms over time through our case law. You know, the sort of the penumbras, they call them, of the Bill of Rights and Constitutions, the emanations, like the right of privacy, which is a freedom to be able to determine what your body should or shouldn't be able to do based on your decision. So we have a lot of freedoms, and they are pretty much all related to liberties. The question always is, when do we have to perhaps not sacrifice but modify our notion of American freedom and liberty and entitlement to provide for perhaps either exigent circumstances or the greater good? When do we have to sacrifice some of our freedoms for something perhaps greater than the freedom promised by that specific freedom? And then, you know, when do we go too far? And when do we curtail our freedoms? Many people thought that the Patriot Act was going too far in the other direction. You know, when do we curtail what we believe to be our freedoms in order to, you know, I put in this in parens or quotes, protect our freedom. So it's, I think these are the questions that courts have to ask that when we have legislation that changes or alters some of these freedoms, the courts have to really fine-tune and ask what it means, how it will be interpreted, when it's overreaching and far-reaching. But the most important thing I think we have to remember on July 4th is to respect and understand that our country is based on the freedom and the equality of the individual to be and do and aspire to all that they can be. And that's something that I think we all can agree on.
And it's great when we agree.
Every once in a while.
Thanks, Amy. We will talk next week. Happy 4th of July.
Same to you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller, Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weidler of Janos Restaurant and the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So what's going on this summer at Janos and the J-Bar?
We've got so much going on, it's hard for me to keep it all straight, but I'm going to try. We've got our summer music series that you know about. We have our summer passports where you dine, and the more times you dine, you collect stamps for free dinners at Janos or J-Bar. Our Janos summer samplers at $19.95, our J-Bar summer samplers at $12.95. At Janos, our 10 terrific taste menu, four courses, 12 different items for $50, drink specials, wine specials, Summer's our time.
I'm starving.
Well, come on over, Rabbi.
What's the phone number for Giannis and the J-Bar?
615-6100.
And the website?
www.janos.com. We've got all our menus up. We've got the summer music schedule up.
And don't forget all the great samplers. We will see you at Giannis and the J-Bar, J-A-N-O-S.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently came back from Germany. Last week we started talking about the Jewish influence in the Rhineland, the area of both German and French, that had such an important part in Jewish history. You know, I think about these great Jewish names, Rashi and Rashbam and the Hasidei Ashkenaz and people who were hugely important Jewish intellectuals, but there's a great deal more to Jewish life. Cologne was sort of at the heart of that.
Right. I mean, one of the sort of obvious points that I forgot to mention last week is that this region first comes to our attention during the time of the Crusades, because the Crusaders sort of did their warm-up exercises in terms of killing the infidel and getting ready for the real infidel, which was the Muslims in the Holy Land, by killing Jews as they went through this region. As they went south and east across Europe, they went through the Rhineland and wreaked a lot of destruction. And a lot of the Jewish memory of life in Christian Europe goes back to that century, really, from the end of the 11th to the end of the 12th century, and that specific region, the Rhine Valley. But what's an interesting sign today, for example, of the importance of the Jewish community of Cologne is that in the large square in front of the town hall, which is called the Rathaus and the Rathausplatz, there are excavations. And the highest level of the excavations, it is easy to see under plastic, or in some cases you can walk around, is of the Jewish community there in the Middle Ages, after the Crusades, but in the, let's say, 12th, 13th, 14th centuries, you can see that there was a synagogue and a mikveh and all the institutions of Jewish life for quite a sizable community. But what's extremely interesting about this particular Jewish community is that they built the central institutions of their community on top of the sites where the Romans had the central institutions of their community, the baths, the arena, the marketplace, etc. So, sort of roughly speaking, 1,000 years ago, there was a Jewish community in this big area in the heart of Cologne. And 1,000 years before that, there was a Roman community when Cologne was an important outpost of the Roman Empire. Also interesting in Cologne, besides the Jewish Museum, is a German-Roman museum where you can see the transition of northwestern Europe from a province of the Roman Empire under great emperors like Constantine the Great, to Christian Germanic little kingdoms and duchies, which Germany then remained until it was united by Bismarck at the end of the 19th century. So there's this sort of gradual, I don't know if it's a descent or ascent into Christendom. And, you know, it's a sad irony of history that Jews basically fared better when they were living under the Romans, who were pagans, than they did when they were living under the medieval Christians in Germany. But obviously they had their ups and downs. And now, with all the streets named after great Jewish heroes and philosophers in Cologne, and with the Tel Aviv Strasse, Cologne is probably one of the most Judeophilic cities in all of Germany, and definitely worth a visit.
Thanks, Tom. Fascinating. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Even though Morris and Sadie have been married a very, very long time, they still decide to visit a divorce lawyer. At the first meeting, the lawyer asked them, why in the world do you want to get divorced? You each look well into your 90s. Why now? Morris replies, actually, I'm 102. My wife, Sadie, she's 101. The lawyer is totally bemused and asks him again, why do you want to get a divorce now? And Sadie replies, well, we wanted to wait until all the children were dead. That was the old, I mean really old, Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Two Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. We now welcome our two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. I've got one other rabbi story, and this is not so much clever as touching. Very famous story. I'm sure many of the listeners have heard it. Once there was this rabbi who had this curious custom on Friday, just before Shabbat, he would kind of just disappear. He wouldn't be there to lead Shacharit services in the morning. He wouldn't even be there in Mincha. He would only show up when it was starting to be time for Kabbalat Shabbat and Ma'ariv, and he would get ready for Shabbat as everyone else did, but no one ever knew where he went during the day. And the students would ask, and the rabbi would never tell. And so one day, one of his students decided that he just had to find out. And so he did something rather brash. He lay under the rabbi's bed before the rabbi came in to sleep that night, and he lay there in hiding and waited. And when the morning came, well, even before the morning, while it was still dark outside, he woke up as he heard the rabbi putting on his boots, getting dressed in the dark. And as soon as the rabbi had slipped out of his room, well, the student followed him. He followed him out of the rabbi's house and out into the forest where the gray light of the dawn was just starting to filter through the trees. And there he watched as the rabbi took out an axe and began chopping up trees and logs that had fallen on the forest floor. And after he had chopped up a nice sizable pile of these, he carried them in his own arms out to a shack far off in the forest. And there, as a student watched, he saw the rabbi deliver all of this wood into the woodpile just outside of the shack. And he saw that an old lady opened the door, an old lady who clearly lived on her own. And the rabbi said to her, Madame, I am just the simple woodchopper, and as always, I've chopped your wood for this Friday. And the lady, she said, But sir, I'm so sorry. I'm too poor. I cannot afford this wood. And the rabbi said, don't worry about it. If you ever can afford it, then you can pay me. And with that, he turned and he started returning to the town, the student hiding behind the tree. Well, that evening, when he got back to the town, the student started whispering with the other students, and they all knew what he had done. And they were asking him, saying, where did the rabbi go? Is it true of the rumors? Did he actually go to heaven in preparation for Shabbat? And the student who had followed the rabbi, he smiled and he said, heaven? Perhaps he went even higher.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last of the Book of Numbers. The setting is on the borders of the Promised Land as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after a 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of the tribes, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. We like the land we're traveling through now, here on the east bank of the Jordan, that is, today, the country of Jordan, long before Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. Reuben and Gad say, let us stay here, build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children. Moses agrees, but in very interesting language. First, he tells them, build towns for your children. Only then build sheepfolds for your flocks. The message is clear. Families come first. Professions and income second. But there's another great message in our double portions this week. The last section, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. That means what we would probably consider vigilante action was the normal means of addressing moral and social disruption that was created by a killing. If you killed somebody, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed thought you had committed the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. That also meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in revenge killing, they wouldn't help much. And so in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge created in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters those cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history until quite recently. And yet the Torah established that principle 3,000 years ago or so. Perhaps even more importantly, it's in this section of Maaseh that the central requirement for a capital case in Jewish law is established. A murderer may not be put to death except by the eyewitness testimony of two adults, a much more stringent standard than used by any death penalty court in America today. Murder, the deliberate taking of human life, it is made clear, is the most serious crime and must be fully punished. But the use of lynch mobs is outmaneuvered by the creation of cities of refuge. Proper witnesses must be secured to give evidence. A trial of law before judges is instituted before any punishment for murder can be applied. Jewish law makes it clear that justice, especially for the worst crimes, has to be careful, exacting, and scrupulously ethical. I wish it was always so in America today. When we come back on To Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk with Rabbi Mark Gopin, a key figure in the movement to end international conflict peaceably by including religion, not excluding it. Find out why that's a crucial part of the equation when we come back on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Obama administration announced that seabound aid to Gaza is, quote, irresponsible. Mechanisms exist for the transfer of humanitarian assistance to Gaza by member states and groups that want to do so, the U.S. State Department said last week in response to questions about Lebanese plans to ship aid to the Gaza Strip by flotilla. Direct delivery by sea is neither appropriate nor responsible and certainly not effective under the circumstances, the State Department added. Back on May 31st, Israel raided the aid flotilla, attempting to breach its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which has been imposed to stop the Hamas terrorist leadership and prevent arms shipments into Gaza. Five boats, of course, were rerouted peacefully, but clashes with the sixth Turkish-flagged ship, the Mavi Marmara, resulting in the deaths of nine passengers and the wounding of seven Israeli troops, set off an international media feeding frenzy. Since then, Israel has loosened the blockade and allowed in all goods, except for those that potentially could provide Hamas with weapons. The State Department said the policy of transferring assistance through Israel has the backing of the international community through the Quartet, the grouping of the U.S., the European Union, the United Nations, and Russia that has created its kind of own Middle East peace process. In other flotilla-related news, an Israeli cabinet minister met with Turkey's foreign minister in Brussels to improve relations between the countries, according to Israeli and Turkish reports. The meeting between Industry, Trade, and Labor Minister Benjamin Ben-Eliezer and Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu, which was supposed to be secret, was in fact disclosed by Israel's Channel 2 TV network. Senior Israeli government officials, I was wondering who the senior ones are, by the way, confirmed the report and said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak approved the meeting, the content of which remains shrouded in secrecy. Both countries reportedly have said that the other initiated the meeting. Turkey, Israel's most important ally in the Muslim world, withdrew its ambassador to Israel and canceled several planned joint military exercises following Israel's interception of the Gaza-bound flotilla on May 31st. Relations between the two countries have been deteriorating, however, since the Gaza War back in 2008-09. In other news from America, a former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court became a big player in the confirmation hearings for Associate Justice nominee to the Supreme Court, Elena Kagan. The former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Israel, however, not the U.S. Way back when she was Dean of Harvard Law School, Elena Kagan once referred to Israeli Chief Justice Aharon Barak as her judicial hero. That recently provoked hostile response by several Republican senators, including Chuck Grassley of Iowa. "I'm troubled by the fact you hold up Barak as a judicial role model," Grassley said. "He's been described as creating a degree of judicial power undreamed of by most U.S. justices." Grassley quoted Barak as saying that a judge has a role in the lawmaking process and asked Kagan if she agreed. She responded she did not and noted that Barak operated in a fundamentally different system, one without a written constitution. Israel, like many countries, does not have one. "Justice Barak's philosophy is so different from anything we would use or want to use in the U.S., she said. Instead, Kagan added she admired Aharon Barak for creating an independent judiciary in a young state surrounded by enemies. "As you know," Kagan continued, "I don't think it's a secret I am Jewish. The state of Israel has meant a lot to me and my family. I admire Justice Barak for what he's done for the state of Israel in ensuring an independent judiciary." Senator Patrick Leahy, the committee chairman, exercised a rarely used prerogative and rebutted Grassley, quoting conservative judges who have praised Barak, including arch-conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. We will stay tuned. In other Kagan news, some Orthodox rabbis have actually challenged her nomination on the ground she is too liberal for them. No surprise, although it is always a disappointment to find Jewish organizations attacking prominent Jews who are well thought of by society. And finally, Shalom Rubashkin, the former head of the discredited and prosecuted agriprocessors kosher meat firm, was sentenced to 27 years in prison for severe immigration and labor law violations. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Mark Gobin. His research on peace and conflict resolution can be found in a number of chapters and articles and journals, but he's the author primarily of Between Eden and Armageddon, The Future of World Religions, Violence and Peacemaking, and Holy War, Holy Peace, How Religion Can Bring Peace to the Middle East, which seems to many, of course, contralogical, and he's started to explain why that's not really so. He is the James Lau Professor of Religion Diplomacy and Conflict Resolution, Director of the Center on Religion Diplomacy and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University, and he has also holds smicha from Yeshiva University. I want to talk a little bit about the role of what people tend to see as ultra-Orthodoxy, both Jewish ultra-Orthodoxy and Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East. Most people would see those as severe problems for creating any kind of a lasting peace. Tell us why that might not be the case.
Well, I think that one of the things that you learn in the context of studying Judaism and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism is that they are in many ways complete systems in a world unto themselves. In other words, most religious psychology and religious worlds, you know, they have their own logic, their own inner world. And none of them operate very easily in the international system of democracy and international treaties and rights and all of these concepts that are secular and modern in nature. So for all of them, it's not an easy fit. But at the same time, you have certain skills associated with these religious traditions, particularly in terms of interpersonal capacities for honor, for respect, for compassion, for care for the poor, for forgiveness and apology and repentance and confession that actually can be the glue that holds together peace treaties.
If you were going to advise a head of state, let's take one, out of nowhere, Benjamin Netanyahu, in terms of how to deal with the current situation in terms of Hamas, Fatah, the complicated ways of dealing with Palestinians, his own internal divisions politically in his own party or his coalition. What would you recommend? What would be the three steps you would recommend him to take?
I would like to see the center of Israel return. In other words, I'd like to see him build a party that's closer to the center. And I think right now he's appealing to extremes that are alienating him from the United States and the rest of the world. So I'm not, if you ask me about whether he should reform his coalition, I think he should, for all sorts of ethical reasons, but also strategic reasons. But if he has the present coalition, which hardly allows him to move anywhere, at the very least, what I would say is, Prime Minister Netanyahu, you have said that you believe the solutions are primarily economic, and in terms of an economic infrastructure for the future here. Well, let's get very detailed about that. If there's nothing to talk about with Hamas and in Gaza because they don't recognize Israel politically, let's talk about jobs. Let's talk about social services. Let's talk about ways in which we can entice the Arab world and the Palestinian community to really believe that we're committed to economic equality with them and respect, because that's a language that religious traditions will understand in the Middle East, and they will respond if we get very, very serious about that aspect of what you're advocating.
You have a new book coming out, To Make the Earth Whole, Creating Global Community in an Age of Religious Militancy. Tell us the main thrust of that argument.
Well, a lot of this is laid out in terms of the fact that and it takes it further. First of all, it focuses on citizen diplomats, the fact that we did all of this work in Syria with very, very little money, but with partnerships between Jews and Arabs that built a new reality based on social network theory, based on the media, based on a high visibility of a very positive and pro-social relationship between interfaith people and also an embrace of people across enemy lines. So that was the story of the citizen diplomacy in Syria. It's an astonishing story of how honored a rabbi ended up being in Syria on all of the media and on a regular basis. And then it's also a set of recommendations of how to move in the future with a way of empowerment of peacemakers that doesn't impoverish them. Most of what we've done until now is that we try to throw money and help peacemakers schlep along. I don't believe that really changes anything. My evidence of 25 years of working on this is that peacemakers need to be self-sustaining and have a lot of dignity. And so I'm trying to create new models here with my young people. I have a big young team at my center on self-sustaining non-profit and for-profit models on social change together across enemy lines. And we feel pretty strongly that this is a model that could work in many parts of the world.
You know, if it worked in Syria, you would think it could work a lot of other places as well. I want to thank...
I specifically went to the most rejectionist place of Israel's right to exist. And part of it was to demonstrate that if you truly honor an enemy, lots of interesting things happen. It doesn't mean that they are happy with Israel's behavior, but it does mean that they're doing a lot of soul searching about having been in a rejectionist position and a pro-terrorist position. And there's a lot of interesting engagement with the United States now that, in fact, my team can take some credit for.
I want to thank Mark Gopin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. You can check out his website, markgopin.com. Great blog and a very interesting set of ideas and discussions. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Sarah Lefton, founder of the website Godcast.com, an animated online version of the Torah. Our playout this morning comes from Kol Beseder and my friend Rabbi Dan Friedlander. In Every Generation is the song in honor of the American celebration of freedom, the 4th of July. My friends, have a happy 4th and a week, we pray, of peace.
In every generation, we must look upon ourselves as if from slavery we were free. Bechol dor bador. In every generation, we must look around and help all the ones who are in need. Bechol dor bador. Chayav adam lirot et atzmo keilu hu yatza. Bechol dor vador, in every generation we must lend a helping hand to the stranger and the friend. Bechol dor vador.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.